This is Learning from Genocide, a series brought to you by the Holocaust Memorial Day Trust. In these episodes, we will be giving a voice to just some of the incredible stories of human endurance in the face of evil. I'm Rachel Century, Head of Research for the Holocaust Memorial Day Trust, and over the next few weeks, as well as talking to experts who have dedicated their lives to raising awareness, we'll also be hearing from those who have survived the Holocaust and atrocities of Cambodia, Bosnia, Rwanda, and Darfur.
The genocide in Rwanda is so badly misunderstood, and I don't think that it's given the status that it should have.
The indirect role they played in me surviving that long was huge.
These are the first-hand stories of the people who were there and who, against all odds, survived genocide. Hello, and welcome back to Learning from Genocide. In this episode, we turn our attention to Rwanda and the 100 days of bloodshed in which a most brutal genocide was committed towards the Tutsi population. The death toll is estimated at well over a million in just 100 days. It's unimaginable to think of the violence which occurred in that short period of time and of the stories we'll never hear. One story we are lucky enough to be hearing today, though, is that of Eric Mwanga, who played in the top football team of the Rwandan capital of Kigali and was protected from the killings by his teammates. I'll be talking to Eric a little bit later in the episode. But first of all, I'm joined by someone who can help us get an overview of how this genocide started and of the groups involved. Linda Melvin is an investigative journalist and author, an honorary professor at the Department of International Politics at the University of Wales, Aberystwyth. Linda has extensively studied the Rwandan genocide against the Tutsis in 1994 and has campaigned to bring the horrors of what happened there into the public conscience. Linda, let's start at the beginning. How did the genocide in Rwanda begin?
The crime of genocide begins with the classification of the population. And in Rwanda, if you look back in history to the colonial rule of the Belgians, you will see increasingly how the population was divided into three groups, Hutu, Tutsi, and Twa. And the Hutu group, as perceived by the Belgians, who issued everyone with identity cards, was the majority, and the Tutsi, the minority. And it began with the classification of the population, this great crime in which we see so many people killed. And it then proceeds to symbolization of those classifications and discrimination against a target group. And what had happened in Rwanda pre-genocide was that there was a quota system whereby the Hutu were, through this system, which was bureaucratized, were given most of the jobs, most of the education, the places in university. So it requires organization, polarization of the population, and then once the population is polarized, you can start scapegoating, and this is a very dangerous stage in the crime, whereas the minority is scapegoated. And this happened in Rwanda, and there was an international peace agreement between the Hutu power government in Kigali and the RPF representing the minority Tutsi, the Rwandan Patriotic Front. And there was a civil war between these two groups, and the Tutsi minority in Rwanda became more and more persecuted. Groups of them were killed. And then you reach the extermination stage of this great crime. And in Rwanda, it was organized for several years. There was a mass import of a machete, the weapon that a militia was trained to use at speed to kill civilians. There was planning of where the roadblocks would be. And there was a complete disregard of the 1948 Genocide Convention, which post-World War II determined that this crime never happened again, that it was the responsibility, certainly, of the UN Security Council to prevent it, and in the worst case, to punish it.
Now, you say that it was planned for quite a while and that the machetes were brought in and the roadblocks were planned. So do you think there was always the intention that the genocide would happen?
I think there was among a certain group of extremists who created a movement called Hutu Power, which was similar to the Ku Klux Klan. You know, it wouldn't allow anyone in whose grandparents had been Tutsi. And there was state agents sent around the country to try to determine whether people had what they called pure Hutu blood. This is appalling racism, and this is exactly where genocide starts. Genocide starts with that sort of extreme racism against one perceived group. Among a certain group of extremists, the intent was always there to destroy the Hutu population of Rwanda in order to avoid power sharing with them. You know, this was a political planned crime at least for 2 years beforehand. This is when the Interahamwe militia emerges in 1992 and has what is terribly called practice runs about how many Tutsi civilians could be killed and how quickly. And this militia was, I think, an American diplomat once called a neutron bomb. You know, it was trained to kill at speed. There was also the preparation through the hate propaganda, you know, this famous RTLM that spewed the most appalling racist material over the airways and also used fake news to tell the population of the fear and terror that Tutsi would cause unless they killed their neighbours. A terrifying period beforehand for the Tutsi, who were certainly at risk. It was absolutely no secret what had been planned. Some Tutsi were sleeping in factories at night because they were so terrified. So yes, everybody saw this coming, but perhaps not exactly the extreme brutality of it and the scale of it.
Can you tell us a little bit about the extreme brutality and the scale of it? The genocide started in April 1994. What happened over the next 100 days?
The genocide started on April the 6th, 1994, and lasted until July the 17th, during which time an estimated 1 million people were killed. It grew in speed and progress countrywide. The Tutsi knew they were targeted and they fled to schools, to clinics, to hospitals and to churches, and, you know, nowhere was safe. The first massacre that the UN peacekeepers discovered, and I describe at length in my book, A People Betrayed, was at Gikondo, a parish within the Kigali city centre. And the Tutsi of Gikondo had fled to the church. And on Saturday morning, 3 days after the genocide began, the army surrounded the church and asked all the Hutu to leave and then sealed the exits, all exits, and allowed the Interahamwe into the church to kill the entire congregation of some 500 people. Outside, the Tutsi who tried to flee were killed in the most atrocious manner. You know, most people in the genocide of the Tutsi bled to death. There was the most terrible mutilations, and this spread countrywide. There was nothing to stop it. The peacekeepers took pictures of what happened at Gikondo. The chief delegate of the ICRC, Philip Gaillard, visited Gikondo on the Saturday afternoon. He told a journalist from Le Monde that this was a genocide of the Tutsi that was underway, and given its speed, it would soon be over. The story appeared in Le Monde on the Monday, April the 11th, that a genocide was underway in Rwanda, and then the story, to one's utter consternation, seems to disappear. And this killing lasted 3 months. I have a cable from May the 12th sent by the head of the peacekeepers, Lieutenant General Romeo Dallaire, giving the exact locations of 726,000 people still at risk, sheltering in churches, hospitals. Kabgayi, the Vatican of Rwanda, turned into a concentration camp. And there are witnesses of this. You know, there are Western journalists who were there. So there are vital witnesses to what happened, not the least the UN peacekeepers who stayed for the duration.
You mentioned earlier that neighbours were involved and that people turned against each other. Were children often involved and enlisted to carry out the bloodshed?
There is a remarkable report on the state of children after the genocide, and it's written by UNICEF, and it's called Starting from Zero. My sources for my book are People Betrayed. I use it, and were an estimated 300 children under the age of 15 who were accused of genocide, and an estimated 250,000 children killed. And afterwards, there were hundreds of thousands of children with no homes and no parents. I think there were suggestions of opening huge orphanages for them, but the Rwandan government of the time decided on local solutions and that these children should be taken care of in local communities. And that's, I think, what happened in the main. I think it was quite shocking to a lot of people that in the immediate aftermath of the genocide against the Tutsi, in those months afterwards, there was immediate talk of reconciliation between what was called the two groups. There was a desire to hold elections. There was, I think, a misunderstanding of this huge event that had taken place. The World Bank wanted the new government that had stopped the genocide to pay back the debts of the previous government, which included the purchases to plan the genocide. It was unbelievable afterwards. The French army helped the perpetrators escape. Had millions now outside the country, the perpetrators, their families, the Hutu population was held hostage in the camps in Zaire. And Hutu power, the movement that had organized this terrible crime, still exists today. It rearmed in the camps, retrained the intra-Hamway, spread out worldwide, spread its propaganda. You know, in Brussels, there's an area where if you're a Tutsi, it's dangerous to walk. But it didn't go away. So this is all part of the aftermath of this great crime, yes.
You've talked about more than a million people being murdered. We've heard you say that neighbours were involved, children were involved. You must have heard thousands of stories, you know, stories of friends and neighbours, family turning against each other. But I was wondering if you could share perhaps a more positive story with us. Do you have an example of something that was a bit uplifting in this bleak picture?
There are uplifting stories. Yes, there are. An orphanage in Nyamirambo, which was saved. There was a Hutu manager who was extremely brave, and his brother has just written a book on the orphanage, which is one of the uplifting stories in Kigali, at least. But for me, I'm thinking about those people, journalists and the lawyers and the politicians who beforehand, before it began, believed that there would be a peace agreement, did all they could to try to bring the community together. And I think particularly of a lawyer called François Zanzuwera, who is now living in Brussels. And he was a lawyer, attorney general for Rwanda. He, before the genocide happened, wanted to hold the killers to account, the Interahamwe to account. And there was a murder in February, a few weeks before the genocide began, of one of those politicians who wanted to bring the community together. He was assassinated, and his name was Félicien Gatabazi. The young lawyer investigated Gatabazi's assassination and realized that it was presidential guard, the extremists, the Hutu extremists around the president, and he arrested someone he thought was implicated. And when the genocide began, the Hutu extremists opened all the prisons. And this man went looking for François Zanzuwera, who in fact was by then, I think, in the Hotel de Mille Collines being protected by peacekeepers. And they went to look for him, and they went to his home, and they found his nephew who was hiding, and they killed his nephew. And then they went to his office, and they opened the safe, and they took all the documents, all the inquiries that had happened before of how Hutu power was eliminating politicians and journalists. And he stood up against these people. And I thought that was immensely brave. For one journalist, the Presidential Guard sent 15 soldiers to make sure that they eliminated him. So there were people who believed there was another way other than violence.
Thank you for sharing that with us, Linda. I find it utterly mind-blowing that even before the genocide had started, there were people that were determined to bring the perpetrators to justice. You know, so clearly there's an awareness, there's knowledge of what's going to happen. And unfortunately, the genocide happens. Mm. I'd like to ask you now about what you think the public understanding of genocide is today. And why do you think it is important for us to talk about genocide that happened in Rwanda?
The genocide against the Tutsi in Rwanda of 1994 is without doubt one of the milestone events of the last century. It broke the world's most atrocious records in the speed of killing civilians. Some international lawyers determine the third clear case of genocide of the last century. It was allowed to happen in spite of the 1948 Genocide Convention, which, even if lawyers will still argue, does not have a legal requirement, then it does have a moral requirement. The Genocide Convention depends on the Security Council of the UN. The UK is a permanent member of the UN Security Council. And I think that we have a special duty to ensure that our government abides by the Genocide Convention in requiring it to be prevented and, in the worst case, to be punished. And I think that that's a very sacred duty on our behalf. And yet, the genocide in Rwanda is so badly misunderstood, and I don't think that it's given the status that it should have. I think that in 1994, the overwhelming focus of attention was on former Yugoslavia. When Oxfam determined on April the 28th, 1994, that a genocide was underway in Rwanda, I have that press release framed on my office wall. The Guardian gave the story 8 paragraphs on an inside page. My own profession failed completely when it came to this. I interviewed a senior UK diplomat once, and he said, well, of course we didn't act in Rwanda. He said, the press nor the public was interested. So I think there are certainly things that we can learn from this when we're ready.
Eric Murangwa was born in eastern Rwanda in 1975, the eldest of six. His family ran a bar and restaurant in a town with a large Tutsi population. Police harassment, which was sanctioned by the ruling Hutu nationalist government towards the Tutsi people, forced Eric's family to close up shop and move to the Rwandan capital, Kigali, in 1992. It was here that Eric developed a passion for football, becoming one of Rayon Sports' best-loved players, a fact that would later save his life. Eric was still a teenager when the bloodshed started, and he's here now to tell us his remarkable story. Eric, let's start by hearing about you and your family. What was life like for you as a child?
I was born in a town called Wamagana in east part of the country. My dad was a senior employee for the company that he worked for. In my early years, he was moved around the country from my first days up until age of, let's say, 7, 8. We moved quite a number of times. I'm the firstborn, so I think my two young brothers were born soon after that. There's not much gap in between three of us. Then, let alone, we also had three more siblings, a sister and two other brothers.
Did you play a lot of football as a child?
Football was very central to my family life. My dad was a huge football fan, and he was always involved in local community football teams. Even himself, playing, taking part in the trainings. The first time I really remember him, seeing him on football field, playing football with other men, was when we were living in this town called Nyamata. Then later on, as I grew up, I could remember when he was very much involved in the Rwamagana Football Club. I wanted to play football, but to be honest, I didn't think at that time that I'll be playing at the level that I ended up playing at.
When did you become aware that things were getting difficult?
That is not something I was very much aware of when I was growing up. The issues of Hutu and Tutsis really began to reach a very dramatic point in the late 50s and early 60s and continued until mid 70s. As someone who grew up in the late 70s and 80s, at that time, it had somehow been pushed under the carpets. It was not something that was talked about, that was obvious in the public domain. And this was down to a number of reasons. One, the Tutsis went through a really harsh treatment between late 50s and early 70s. It was during that period where many of them were killed and even more were forced out of the country. And the regime that was in power in Rwanda at the time was extremely Hutu extremist ideological regime. So the Tutsis who somehow survived during that period of late 50s and mid 70s, they were kept quiet, and they decided also to keep quiet so that they can be able to survive. So that's why people like myself who grew up in that particular period, late 70s, 80s, we were not that much aware of what had happened earlier. In public, the way things were done, if you were as young as I was, you could not easily see that it was a very hostile and extremist regime around. Having said that, there were things such as singling out Tutsi children in schools that was everywhere, was something that everyone who went to school knew that as a Tutsi, you were not treated like anyone else. I remember teachers used to ask Tutsi children to stand up and be identified and counted. It was well known that if you are a Tutsi child, your chances of progressing to a secondary school was almost zero. It was almost impossible to get scholarship to go to university, even if you had managed to reach the secondary school level. So those were things that were well known.
And when exactly was it clear that genocide had started?
By 1993, the killings had arrived in the capital city. Tutsis in different neighborhoods had to be forced out of their homes, and then they went for hiding or looking for refuge. The genocide started on the evening of April 6, 1994, but the signs had been pretty much there throughout the last 2 years, mostly the last 6 months. Then came the moment that pretty much kicked everything off, when the president's plane was shot down. And as soon as that happened, the genocide started. The military, especially the presidential guard, and then the militia groups started putting roadblocks in every corner of the city, going out, singling out individuals that they knew were more likely to be their obstacles. They were the first to be targeted from that night on April 6. By the next day, the killings extended to ordinary members of Tutsi community. Soldiers and the militia went house by house. They also knew who were in those places, because most of the time they came with the lists and they would call out names. And they will gather people, they look at the lists. If someone is missing, they will have to find where that person is. So this went on for the next 100 days. Personally, I was affected on the second day. That's when I was attacked by a group of soldiers who came into the house where I was staying with another friend of mine. They came into our house claiming to look for weapons. This was an excuse. This was their strategy of pretty much proving why they were targeting ordinary people. Football became the reason why I survived. After that incident with the soldiers that coming to my house, one of the soldiers, he came out to be a fan of Rayon Sport Football Club, which is the club that I was playing for. recognized me through the photos that he saw in the photo albums, among things that they were throwing up and down in the house looking for those weapons. And when he recognized me, that was pretty much the reason why my life and the life of my housemate and actually my neighbors were spared. Once he knew I was who I was, he asked his colleagues to step out of the room. And then the next few minutes, we were talking about football. So we sat on the sofa and we went on about this football game that we had played a month earlier against a Sudanese club called Al Hilal. He apparently was at that game, and all he wanted to talk was about that football game. So yeah, that moment pretty much saved my life. Following day, I left and went to my parents' house, which was not far from where I was staying. And when I arrived there, I found them shaken, obviously, having seen what had happened in the last 24 hours. They were also attacked by soldiers, but luckily they survived. Free those away from my parents' house was a group of teammates of mine living in this house together. At one point, I thought maybe going to their house would be more comfortable, more safe for me than staying at my parents' house. So I went. When I arrived there, they really made me feel welcome. So I ended up staying at that place for another 2 to 3 weeks. The indirect role they played in me surviving that long was huge.
What was it like for the rest of your family?
Our neighbors were not that bad at the beginning. Obviously, things changed later on. Almost the whole month of April, the neighborhood that my parents were in, if you compare to other neighborhoods that were surrounding us or in any other part of the city, it was a little bit different, mainly because the people who were in that neighborhood were not as extremist as those in the other part of the city. The reason why you had neighborhoods that were badly affected from the beginning, it was always because of how people in those neighborhoods were influential. So people who were in higher level in terms of society. And the more these people happen to be government officials, members of people in the government, and these people were the ones who pretty much directed and mobilized ordinary people in their neighborhoods to actually get involved in the killings at the beginning. So we didn't have that, hence why the first 2-3 weeks were a little bit different compared to these other places.
How did you survive at this point? And what did the people around you do to help?
My teammates, the fact that they were public figures, they were people who were well-known in the neighborhood, well-respected, and they were Hutus. So they carried some kind of respect and responsibility towards what was happening in the neighborhood at the time. And this, to some extent, also was extended to how my parents were also less impacted because they were also the neighbors. But obviously, this didn't last for long. By late April, more and more people had been radicalized, encouraged to get involved in the killings. There were calls on the radio that people who doesn't seem concerned with what's going on, they should also be treated as accomplices of the nation enemy. So ordinary people in the neighborhood, they also started becoming more involved and more bad. Some of them would not get involved in the killings, but they will play a part of what they used to call gutunga gatoki, which is pointing a finger. So basically announcing you. They would go and then talk and collaborate with the more extremist people from different neighborhoods, and then they will come and attack people in our neighborhood. At the end of April, when a group of militia came looking for me, 3 guys, they somehow kidnapped me. Normally, when you were taken away like that, the chances of surviving were almost below zero. But somehow I survived that moment because we walked for about half a mile or so, and then they wanted to find out if I had any money, took my wallet, checked inside the wallet. I had a number of foreign currencies notes. So every country that I had traveled to playing football, I collected their notes. They took it, and then they asked me if I had any more money that three men can be able to share. And I told them I don't have any with me, but if we can go back home, then I can get more money for them. So we went back. I took them to my teammate's house. So when we go there, my teammates, you know, came out and really did all they could to try and rescue me from the hands of these guys. We somehow managed to put together about 60,000 Rwandan francs and then gave it to these guys. They also ransacked the house. They said that they were not going to leave me behind, unfortunately, because they had been ordered to bring me with them. At that moment, something happened. So one of my teammates, when we came back into the house, he had just walked out of the house with a cousin of his who was a soldier in the Rwandan government forces at the time. They were apparently going somewhere. He had asked his cousin to come and accompany him somewhere. So when we were returning to their house, a neighbor saw us, saw me with this free militian entering my teammate's house. As the neighbor was just, you know, going about his business, he came across my teammate and his cousin soldier standing by the main road. And then this neighbor told my teammate that what he had seen. As soon as my teammate heard about that, he asked his cousin to come back home and see what was going on. So when all these things were happening inside the house, I didn't know this soldier was outside. The teammate and his soldier cousin came back, and then my teammate came into the house. He was part of the discussion that went on, but his soldier cousin stayed by the door. As they were forcing me to go with them again, that's where we came across this soldier. And then he challenged them, rescued me from them, and then they left. So after that, it was when we decided that I should go and look for refuge somewhere else, because it was obvious that these guys, they would definitely try and come back.
You know, it sounds like your options of where to find refuge must have been running out at this point. Where did you go next?
That's how I ended up at the place of another fan of my football club, a man called Jean-Marie Vianen, also known as Zuzu. Luckily, Zuzu agreed to take me in, even though he was pretty much part of the genocide machine as one of the leaders of the militia groups. But he accepted to take me in. I stayed at his place. And eventually, he suggested that I should tell him where he could take me in the city, because he was also planning to leave the city. I told him that he could take me to International Red Cross headquarters in downtown. One morning, we drove from our neighborhood of Nyamirambo all the way to Kiyovu neighborhood, where is International Red Cross was. Stay there again for, I think, 2 to 3 days. And then arrangement was made for me by the director of International Red Cross in Rwanda to go to Milcolin Hotel. Milcolin Hotel is the place where famous Hotel Rwanda movie story came from. Was there for another maybe 2 to 3 weeks until people who were there were evacuated from the hotel to the outskirts of Kigali, the area that had been captured by the RPF. And this was done through a negotiation that the RPF and then Rwandan government. End of May, early June, that's when we evacuated from Hotel Milcolin to the LRPF controlled zone. And yeah, my survival journey came to an end.
If you want to learn more about Eric's unbelievable story of survival against all odds, then go to our website, hmd.org. www.genocide.org. Eric has been involved in several initiatives using football as a tool to promote tolerance, unity, and reconciliation. You can find out more at his website, ishamifoundation.org. My thanks to Linda and Eric for joining me today and to give us the opportunity to educate ourselves about a genocide which the world knows very little about, despite it happening in plain sight. In the next episode, I'll be talking to two people who in different ways were directly affected by the genocide in Bosnia and who are willing to open up about the atrocities which face them and their families.
I was playing outside with my brother and sister, and I ran into the house and my mom was just sitting in front of the TV and she was crying.
I didn't really know a lot about the Srebrenica massacre, and when I got to find out that it did first-handedly affect my mother and my father, I did feel such a connection to that.
Goodbye for now. Learning from Genocide is produced by Amanda Redman and is brought to you by the Holocaust Memorial Day Trust and Trafalgar Strategy. For more information on the stories that you've heard today and ways for you to be involved in what we do, please go to our website, hmd.org.uk.